Well, I applied for a job, which was I had been I was a social worker, qualified as a social worker in England. I had lots of family connections to Ireland. Both my parents were from the west of Ireland, but I'd been brought up in England, and I'd been working in a London as a social worker, but in a flat that was breaking up. And I had friends who'd come back to Ireland and to Dublin, and I decided I'd make a change. I had applied for a job in London that I kind of got but wasn't sure about, but I applied for this job that I saw advertised. I actually applied for two jobs in Ireland, the Cherish job and a job with the Health Board. And I think, if I remember rightly, the Health Board only got round to acknowledging my application after Cherish had offered me the post. But Cherish were looking at that time for a social worker. They were very clear that if, as a support organisation, they wanted to be taken seriously, they were going to need to employ professionals who would support them in that role. At the time, social workers simply did not respect that women who were parenting alone had anything of value to say about parenting alone. And so this sense of you needed to have the professional to deal with the professionals was very much part of the kind of the 1970s, I think. So they advertised the post. I saw the post and thought it was really interesting. I had, in London, I was working kind of on a geographical base across a whole series of issues in social work terms. And so to come to work with an organisation that was really interested in a single issue, albeit with all the bits that went around that, but perhaps most of all, an organisation that was about, was truly a self-help organisation, and they were rare in the 1970s, was an enormous kind of attraction. So I applied for the job and got it and didn't look back. My sense of the first time, I can remember going to my interview, but I went to a party that night in the Pembroke Street house. So I'd gone for this interview where there were a number of people who were working in the field of social work. The Cherish had already very neatly kind of tied in. You know, the woman who was the head of social work in Trinity, I think, interviewed me, and a couple of other women who were fairly well established in. So they'd already got their kind of tie-in bits. And I remember going to the interview and was fine. I mean, asked lots of interesting questions. But that night there was a party in the Cherish House, and the thing that completely threw me is people said to me, "Oh, so you're going to be our new person?" I thought, "Hang on, I've only just done the interview. I don't know that I'm going to be offered the job." But it was fascinating because you had this whole range of people at the party, fairly senior law lecturers. You had a set of, I can't remember the political people there, certainly some journalists. And you suddenly got this sense of this incredibly vibrant organisation that really knew what it was doing. Or if it didn't really know what it was doing, really knew what it wanted to do and was very well on the road to kind of thinking all of that out. So that was my first memory. And I went back and told everybody else about it. It was really exciting. So there was a real mix of one-to-one work, advice and guidance, and I suppose what might be traditional social work. There was always a very strong commitment to group work in Cherish, and there was a regular kind of, I think probably even weekly meeting, if not monthly, I forget, maybe weekly, monthly meeting where people could simply drop in. And then there was the policy work and some press work and that kind of real mix of things. Lots of advice and information, people writing, not much. Probably some phone at that time, but certainly all the email and stuff just wasn't there at that time. So there was a real mix in the job of what I kind of had started out in terms of formal social work, but an opportunity to do a whole range of things around particularly policy work and media work and so on that I simply had not done before. But at the core of it, there was that piece about there were women in very difficult personal situations who did not have good advice, and it wasn't easily available to people. And Cherish was possibly one of the very few places where you could get comprehensive advice and unbiased advice. And it wasn't there at the time. And so Cherish's capacity to provide that was, I think, looking back, was hugely, hugely important. And it held an integrity about the way that it did that, and was absolutely clear from the day it got established that this was about choosing. It wasn't about keeping your child and living with your child was the only option. It was about how do we make a scenario where women have choice. And we tried to do that with integrity, I think. And I think my personal view is it was done with integrity. But as I was saying, people, you know, for some women it was, there were certainly scenarios when women arrived at the Cherish house very, very, very close to their due delivery date and hadn't spoken to anybody. And that's, in any circumstances, was very, very scary and a very serious indictment of Irish society. The difference in terms of attitudes around those kind of social things from 40 years ago to now, it just, you know, it's hard to even kind of conceive about where they were. I mean, I think when I came to work in Cherish, something like maybe 95% of children born outside marriage were placed for adoption or it remained in care. I mean, some enormous figure. And all the resources were going into adoption societies and so on. So all the resources were also in that support framework for adoption, really. Contraception wasn't a matter for discussion. you know, we were heading in. I'm not sure what the timing was then about the famous contraception train, but I think a bit after Cherisher got established, contraception was not a matter for public discussion, and certainly not easily got or secured. And abortion simply was not a matter for discussion, full stop. I think if I can think back, there was perhaps two kind of key thematics that were on the top of the agenda when I was working in Cherish. Was one was the status of illegitimacy. You know, I mean, if there was the one driver or motivator, it was that to achieve that legal change. And I think the second one was, and it's a bit kind of a less kind of formally articulated, was about getting the understanding that women, and it was nearly all women, women parenting alone faced enormous problems, but parenting alone of itself was not a problem. And trying to win that understanding was really fundamental to, I think, the way that Cherish went about its work in its early years, that these are women, family units that function perfectly well as other family units. They have some pressures because of housing and because of income and those kinds of things, but of themselves, a one-parent family unit can be as successful, as positive, as supportive, as nurturing, as everything else. But that wasn't understood at the time. Well, I think housing was always perhaps the most significant problem that women faced. Complicated, I think, by the fact that the public housing system at that time was massively connected to marital families. And retrospectively, there was a scenario where a one-parent family could get the same kind of points as a two-parent family. But at that time, that just didn't happen. And therefore, women didn't see the point in registering with the Public Housing Authority. And then because they didn't register with the Public Housing Authority, the Public Housing Authority didn't think there was a demand. So you got kind of a decreasing circle. And there was not that everybody saw their future living in public housing units, but that articulation of demand hadn't really happened around housing, and so that was a big issue. Work, childcare, was an enormous issue. There generally was not childcare provision. Women with children weren't expected to work. Childcare was expensive. It wasn't easy to get or to sort out. So your capacity to continue in work was challenged by those costs. Societal attitudes, of course. There was one instance, I think, when something had occurred about, you know, well, you could have a whole lot of people who might talk about kind of, well, I'd be in favour of contraception. The women in Cherish were the people who clearly had sex outside marriage. And that simply, you know, was you, they were putting it up there to a level and a degree that other people might have been having sex outside marriage, might be happy to talk about it, but weren't personally labelled in that way. And at that time, to be labelled as having sex outside marriage was something, it was about unacceptable social behaviour. So you had all those kind of multiplicities of things coming together. People whose families simply couldn't find the way to be supportive. Women who left home and their communities and didn't go back because they didn't think they could. Women who went into a mother and baby home for the once their pregnancy started to be evident and never told anybody. I mean, those were the kinds of scenarios. It was a very hard time for people who were leading what was a radical social change. How did people perceive the women in Cherish? I think they thought they were harridans. I think they thought that they were immoral. I think they thought that they were misguided, perhaps more charitably. I think what was interesting is that politicians and policymakers actually thought that they were very competent, because they were. They managed very well this balance of a radical public persona with very functional, well, how will we move these matters on kind of thinking. So they hit that balance of public profiling and practical doing very, very well. I think they were very, very good at that. I think they got a lot of personal abuse. I mean, I can remember we used to do a pub fundraising, you know, going around rattling boxes. It was grief-ridden. You know, if you took it personally, you'd really be upset, but there'd be enough of us and we'd be smart-assed as well, you know, and you'd kind of be able to take on the kind of, so you're an unmarried mother and, you know, I'm not surprised you left your kind of nonsense or, you know, or, are you an unmarried mother? Well, what does an unmarried mother look like? I don't know. Well, then, you know, maybe I am and maybe I am and kind of stuff. So it was challenging. But I think perhaps the most difficult, I think sometimes some key people in power could be incredibly condescending. And that was really, really hard to take, that bit about you poor things, you know. And that used to drive everybody completely nuts and got entirely we are not poor things response, which they then were very pleased about, you know. So I think it was a very mixed view, a very mixed perception. But the women who set up and ran Cherish were very, very competent, very able women with very, very great vision. I think networking was a key piece of what Cherish, certainly in the, I think all Cherish and its kind of more modern manifestations has always done very well, was that acknowledgement that the solution or the societal change, which in effect what they were looking for, was not in their own hands. You know, it was about changing a whole pile of things that kind of fitted around that. And you were only going to achieve that if you could kind of find your influences and your friends. Friends were, you know, I think probably the women in Cherish were the first people who really taught me this piece about make sure you know who your friends are in the decision-making systems and mind them and encourage them and advise them. And you'll have some possibility of people holding your corner for you when pressure gets generated. So they'd really worked out about where they needed to make their networks and then their influence. I think that looking back, that the choice of parenting alone was a choice of low income, you know, that for some people, because they had come perhaps from quite well-paid work and now they were involved in needing to stabilise perhaps their accommodation and needing to sort out their childcare costs and just simply the costs of another person who needed all those support and supervision issues. And I think for other people, simply that, you know, they didn't have the same earning capacity and the costs associated with parenting and maintaining work were too high. So I think certainly in the early stages of Cherish, it was very, very, very difficult for a number of women to maintain paid employment and to be a lone parent. People were under economic pressure. I think it was always a common issue for everybody. And that really hasn't changed. You know, I think we get affected by, I mean, now there's all the discussion around, in particular, the change in the income disregard for social welfare payment and the impact of that, which is enormous. But the decision to parent alone was a decision to face more economic pressure, and still is. In any scenario, people's capacity to have a guaranteed minimum income, no matter whether it's, well, it does matter whether it's adequate or not, but to know what you might have to live on is crucial to all of us, but particularly to us if we're bringing up children. And so the securing of what was then the unmarried mother's allowance as a recognition of the additional responsibilities of parenting alone was an enormous progress. The fact that the change in the law made the use of the language of illegitimate no longer legal was an enormously important success for Cherish. It was Cherish who led that campaign, it was Cherish who articulated the arguments around that campaign, and it was Cherish that achieved the change in that really negative language of illegitimacy, and that was enormously kind of important. I think the issues about fathers' engagement and contribution have been around for a long time. I think Cherish always acknowledged, and One Family, the importance of trying to engage for both parents to have an important and central role in the bringing up of their kids. And my personal view is I think that men aren't well served by the law. Sometimes haven't served themselves well either, but that's a slightly different matter, I think. So I do believe that we should do everything that we can to try to enable parents to acknowledge their parenting role to the fullest possible degree. I think the challenge is continue. I still think there are social attitudes about women and about men, perhaps increasingly now, who are parenting alone. And there are perceptions that lone parent families, single parent families, one parent families do not function or do not have the same family potentiality as a two parent family. And you see that in all kinds of things. Oftentimes when in my current work you hear people talking about families under pressure, the status of being a lone parent is one of the things that gets mentioned. Now, of course it's a problem in terms of, as I say, all those societal challenges that wrap around it. But I do think still that there are attitudes about families that are led by a lone parent and their capacity to parent. And I simply don't accept that. But I think that there has been an enormous shift in people's confidence and understanding about the capacity of family units that are headed by a lone parent than there was in the 1970s. In the 1970s, you were assumed to be some way incompetent, on the fringe, and it was rare enough to meet a family headed by a lone parent, except as somebody said in Cherish, where a partner had died, but that was a situation when somebody, the partner, was respectably dead, as opposed to being a lifestyle choice that somebody had made. So it was quite different, but I think the challenges still continue. I think the recognition of alternative and different family frameworks is crucial now. I think it's the next big legal issue. It simply isn't helpful that Irish legal practice continues to be based on a marital family. It's archaic and it's unhelpful. But I can remember enough about kind of the divorce referenda in particular, about these issues that then flow around property and property rights and who loses and who gains. Very contested, very contentious, very divisive, very damaging discussions that went on, and all tied back in the end to ownership of property and wealth, and I suspect that's not gone away. I think that we need to go back to understand that parenting alone is a matter that needs and merits societal support, and that we should care about children and families, and we should make that care real. And that's about, I think, then thinking about those contextual issues around, as I was saying, childcare and after-school care and parental supports, and how do you create, support people to create supporting networks? How do you enable people to maintain work if that's what they want to do and can do? How do you enable people to go back in and continue their education? How do you create sense of equal opportunity, because it isn't there